The following recording was retrieved on October 7th, 2023. This is the only known episode of the NetSurfer Pro podcast known to exist in this universe. Others are theorized to exist, but this is the only one that the Foundation currently has. We will play it for you now.
Beep. I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web.
The web.
Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
You know what day it is?
Oh boy, it's my favorite day.
It's drumroll please. 10, 12.
Oh, I love it.
You know what? You know why 10, 12 is so big of a deal, right?
Yeah, but for the viewers at home.
Okay, so think about the number 10, and then think
about.
Well,
hang on, I'm still thinking about the number 10.
Okay, you got it in your head? What number are you thinking of?
10.
Good. Now, think about the number 12.
Okay, hang on, let me add 2. Okay, alright, I've got the number 12 in my head.
Now, what's sort of interesting about those numbers?
They're both divisible by 5? Wait, they're both divisible by 3.
Neither!
Hang on. 10, 12, they both have 1 at the beginning.
Very good, and?
They stand for A-AB.
A-AB?
A-AB.
Would you like to explain what that means for the listeners at home?
Well, have you ever read the British version of Moby Dick? That's,
that's
what
they call
it. Yeah,
it's Cotton Ahab.
Oh, it's Cotton Ahab.
Cotton Ahab.
Call me Ishmael. We've run out of ideas.
Oh, I'm Ishmael.
This is NetSurfer Pro, World and Rise of the World Wide Web. I'm Galen.
I'm Matthew Marissa.
Look, we don't have any ideas for this one, man. We prepared all week,
but I can't actually remember what we prepared about.
Yeah, it's like a void in my memory. I think that the last thing I remember us doing was an episode over the SCP Foundation?
The Shitcock Penis Foundation?
Yeah!
Oh,
wait,
right.
No, that was last year. This year is Secure Contain Protect Foundation.
Okay. And next year it's slated to be Wink. I'm tossing the ball into your court.
The Some Cool People Foundation.
Nice. There we go. Good setup. Good spike.
Yep.
Yeah. So we did that. And then we started talking about what to do next. I know we mentioned doing one of the stories, one of the biggest stories.
Yeah, it's like one of the most important stories, one of the most popular.
I just looked at my hand really quick.
Hang on, it's...
Why does my hand feel... Hold on, I'm remembering now. We're talking about fingers!
Oh, right! We're talking about Freddy Got Fingered.
SCP named Finger.
Yeah!
No.
SCP named Finger is a Keter class.
Okay, so...
Hang on, wait. Okay, yeah, it's coming back to me now, too. Okay, it wasn't the Finger one. It's not the SCP named Finger. It was the one about the division that we don't have. The mimetic division?
Oh, you mean the number we don't have that divides 10 and 12.
Yeah!
Which is related to the anti-mimetics division.
Oh, so, that's what we're talking about today.
Yeah. And it's called... We did that because after listening to the intro to this episode, you'd wish that you had never known or been able to know about this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
if we can turn this podcast into something that just sort of blanks itself, you know, destroy after listening kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
that just blanks itself in your mind after listening, we would. Trust us, we would.
So here is sort of a fun bit about the SCP Wiki, is that not only is it a wiki in terms of the style that it's written in, but the way it's structured is also like a wiki with, you know, you can just search things on a search bar to find pages. Pages linked to other pages, there's explanation pages, but also there are hubs, which are a thing Wikipedia does to sort of create a landing page for a concept. So, I'm pretty sure there is, I don't know off the top of my head exactly, there's probably, a physics hub or, a science hub.
There's a Dotto hub, related to someone we talked to before.
In SCP Wiki. I'm talking about the real Wikipedia.
There's a Dotto Hub in Wikipedia.
Yeah, but that's talking about, like, Marcel Duchamp. Yeah, the idea of a hub is that it is essentially a main page within the main wiki to make it easier to find things within a certain topic.
Yeah, so if you're looking for, say, everything about philosophy or, like you said, physics.
Or porn.
Or porn.
But anyways, there is a hub for any of those.
Like porn.
Or the hub that contains shows such as My Little Pony and Dan Versus and the Aquabat Super Show. Rest in peace, the Aquabat Super Show.
Rest in peace, Dan Versus.
It's a good show. Maybe we'll talk about it one of these days. Maybe not. But the SCP Wiki uses these hubs for things like groups of interest or people of interest, such as the aforementioned Dotto. But also, when you think about it, if you took a hub, you could then kind of just list several skips or articles in an order for, like, a reading order, essentially creating multiple chapters within a series. Enter the series hubs. Essentially, these are more long-form storytelling methods within the SCP Wiki that adhere to the wiki format and structure by being a hub that you can visit that has links to other articles relevant to the hub. But in this case, and in many other cases, the series hub contains a story that is connected between different articles.
Yeah. It can sometimes vary between a literal article itself and a fiction piece. It's pretty clear whether or not it's, like, sort of in lore, quote-unquote, or if it is fiction based off of the lore, kind of depending on just reading it. It's the kind of thing where if it reads like a standard story, it's probably not canon, quote-unquote, but it is using the canon of the SCP Foundation to tell a self-contained story.
Well, canon is a very dubious thing with SCP Wiki, as we've talked about before. Typically, you can view a series hub as a single timeline or grouping of timelines where it is canon to the series hub. This will come up very importantly in another episode we're planning, but for this one, you can think of everything within this hub, which is the Antimimetics Division hub, as one coherent timeline of events.
Yeah, one coherent narrative.
And part of that is helped by the fact that, for the most part, this is written by one singular author, which I think takes us to the fact corner.
Yes.
The fact corner.
So, the Antimimetics Division, the hub, the series, all started with one SCP-55, which we mentioned briefly in the previous episode, which was written by Quantum, Q-N-T-M. This was then given some time to sort of simmer, and several other SCPs were written by a few different authors, such as 1425, the Ojai Church, which was written by Silberescher, 33, which is the constant / theta prime, which is a number that doesn't work with our number system, which was written by Mulciber, and 2828, which is a thing behind the ear by Ublex. 2828 is fun because it's also a great example of Ticonderoga, which is an SCP that can't be contained because it's part of everyday life. The concept of Antimimetics Division, though, was then taken and turned into a serialized narrative by Quantum, creating the Antimimetics Division hub. There is a set of 5 stories, and then a brief intermission, and then another set of 5 stories that were written later. You can think of this as like a season 1 and season 2. These were then later compiled into an actual print book you can buy and have on your shelf called There Is No Antimimetics Division.
The physical book is how I primarily experienced this, because I have a roommate who is a big fan of buying cool books based off of internet works. And it works. It reads very well. I feel like if I really were splitting hairs, you probably would get a slightly more authentic experience reading the wiki itself, just because, like, the format itself kind of lends to the narrative. But the print book, like, the fact that there is a print book is kind of insane. I'm not going to get into it right this second, because I'm going to be praising this thing a lot throughout the episode, but, like, the fact that this is a book based off of a community-written wiki that, like, had enough through lines, had enough interesting things that somebody was like, I could just write a whole series about this, and then later on was like, I could just print this as its own self-contained book, is cool.
Yeah, generally, this is part of the sort of the licensing and rights behind the SCP Foundation, is that while the works are in the Creative Commons, generally people will respect that, like, you probably shouldn't make money off of something if it's not yours.
Yeah.
I think, like, there's some things where there are adaptations, such as the Infinite IKEA or Containment Breach in general, where, like, those are kind of drawing from the more grander SCP, and it's a lot harder to say, like, hey, you can't do that, that's mine.
Plus, but there's also, like, in that case, there's also an amount of, like, effort being put into making a physical video game based right. off of it, so...
But when it comes to the actual writing, it's like, the writing is still sort of belongs to the person who wrote it directly.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the idea's present. Other people can make their own SCPs or stories that reference the events within the Antimimetics Division. They just can't print off a book and sell it of the stories within the Antimimetics Division. Now, that being said, I want to go over some of the suggested pre-reading, which are the SCPs that I just mentioned, because especially two of them that are super important and relevant to the actual events of There Is No Antimimetics Division. Really quick, we need to talk about 55, which is not... I'm not talking about the story, we need to talk about 55.
Yeah, that's just a statement.
Yes.
This is not the story part.
So SCP-55 is not round.
It is not round. I believe it is also not a square, although the most popular version of it is it's not a sphere, I think.
Yeah, so SCP-55, you can observe it, you can look at it, you can recognize it, but the moment it is now no longer being observed, you cannot remember it. You know that you have looked at something with something that is contained and labeled SCP-55. You know that it's in the room, you just can't tell what it is. However, you are able to tell what 55 is not, to an extent, so you can narrow down a general idea of what it is. Hence the line, 55 is not a sphere, I yeah. think. It's you can't even state facts of what it is. So if you knew what it is, you can't say what it is.
An important part as well is that it is kind of averse to, like, being photographed, being written about, having notes taken about it, and the actual process of, like, how the containment unit was made, who made it, who put the item there, who, like, you know, even, I think who wrote the article itself is also, like, known to be unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's explicitly stated on the article that nobody knows, there is no documentation over these facts.
Yeah, it kind of has a bleed-over effect. And this is a good example of what an antimimetic concept is. An antimimetic is something that is hard to think about, doesn't want to be known, and often is very easy to forget.
Yeah.
It is actively against the concept of thought and observation, as observation is sort of a type of thought. A lot of these are typically invisible to most people, and once they're visible, oh boy.
Yeah, the idea of an anti-meme is really interesting because, of course, it comes from the idea of a meme, which is, in the purest form, a unit of culture. So an anti-meme is something that resists trying to become a unit of culture.
In some ways, it's just a meme is an idea that can spread, and an anti-meme is an idea that's impossible to spread, or very difficult to spread. And 55 is a great example. Now, here comes 1425, which is a bit complicated because it's not really an anti-meme. If anything, 1425 is a meme, a dangerous one, because 1425 is a cult. It started in Ojai, California, and it takes the form, or like the description is of a self-help book that says to like perform a ritual to the stars to get your wishes. It has things like what time of day and how many days you need to do the ritual. The ritual involves like you find out what star you are praying to. You pray to it, and the star will eventually vanish. And people do get their wishes granted, but they also, like, start biting off their fingers and start, like, cutting open their own necks. It is a mass, like, it's a cult that spread super quickly. It even mentions in the article how there were, like, talk show appearances by celebrity endorsements saying about how great it is. And it's essentially Scientology.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think 1425, to me, very clearly felt like Scientology. And I'm pretty sure the talk show bit is a Tom Cruise Oprah type thing.
Knowing the time period that the thousands were made, I genuinely wouldn't be surprised if that was a big inspiration.
Scientology was definitely more of a big topic in the 2000s.
In the internet sphere specifically as well.
Yeah. But I mean, even South Park had a whole bunch of shit thrown towards it. And I think things like the concept of a celestial body that can, like, that is what you pay for. Telling people that they can get what they want is a cult thing in general, but, like, a lot of the specifics of how it spreads through, like, celebrity vectors is very Church of Scientology.
Yeah.
This thing, I think, spreads all throughout America, and, like, there starts to get to be just essentially, like, zombies or just mass madness waves until they all disappear, leaving behind very little traces. Collectively, like, a month was just gone from the world's history. Keep that in mind. So, with those out of the way, let's talk about 55. Or rather, we need to talk about 55.
Yeah, we need to talk about 55.
Yes.
55. So, We Need to Talk About 55 is the first side story in the Anti-Mimetics Division storyline.
First main story.
Yeah, it's the first main story. It's the first chapter.
Yeah.
Essentially, what happens is a agent named Marion Wheeler is summoned to an O5's office, an O5 being one of the foundation, like, the founders, and they're the biggest people.
They're overseers.
Yeah, they're the overseers. Seavers. She gets summoned into their office. The secretary's like, all right, go on in. And she sits down, and there is an O5 member who is only ever described as, well, founders never look how you expect. That's the only physical description he gets. And his, like, assistant named Clay. And so she, like, sits down, and she's like, all right, what did you want to talk about? And Clay produces a pistol and aims at her head. And she's like, all right, we're doing this then. And so the founder's like, we have no record of you. Who are you? And she goes, oh my fucking god, I am the chief of your anti-mimetics division. He's like, we don't have an anti-mimetics division.
There is no anti-mimetics division.
We have a mimetics division, we have a psychokinesis division, we have a field researchers 1 and 2, we have operatives, blah blah blah, but we don't have an anti-mimetics division. And so Wheeler, which is what I'm going to call her for shorthand because that's what the story does, essentially explains the concept of an anti-meme and is like, for example, 55, which gets him, you know, gets the founder to be like, we don't have a 55. We, you know, we skip things. And she's like, no, there is an SCP-55. It isn't round. It isn't square. It isn't blue or green. But it is an anti-meme.
So a bit of a note here. Clay is the one who says there is no 55. We skip the numbers.
Yeah, that's right.
Clay specifically says it.
Wheeler explains that there are exactly 2 anti-memes in the room with them. One of them is SCP-4987, which follows her around. It is essentially trained. And the founder's like, and the other one? Or no, I think Clay is the one who says...
No, the founder says the other one.
The founder says, and the other one? And that's when Wheeler produces Clay's pistol and shoots him in 2 times in the chest.
And Clay's like, how did you know?
And then she shoots him in the head again. Yeah. And the founder's like, huh, so he was an anti-meme. How did you know? And Marion's like, you are a founder. There is 1 desk in here. You don't have an assistant. Your secretary is outside right now. You should have known that he was not actually part of your, part of this.
And to make matters worse, during this time, Marion describes the concept of Nestix. Medicine that is taken to remember things.
Yes.
All the overseers, as well as Marion and the higher-ups of this division, have to take a lower-level amnestic.
A lower-level Nestic. It's class X. Nestics are W, X, Y, and Z. So right. I think it's W, because that's the lowest.
A class W Nestic, 2 times a day. And she even mentions that you can't forget to take it unless something forced you to forget.
Yeah.
In this instance, the overseer was not taking their Nestics because Clay had, like, been essentially making them forget about it.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a really fun sort of twist. I think it's pretty well implemented because a lot of the things that are, like, that Clay does don't seem super weird at first. I think it's not until Marion brings up 55 and Clay insists they don't have one, but the Overseer finds it on the page. Because, like, I think that's the point where Clay starts to act very sus.
Yeah.
You could be like, oh, there's only one desk and there is a secretary. Why does he have an assistant? But at the same time, that doesn't seem specifically weird. Maybe it's some bureaucratic nonsense. Maybe the O5 gets special privileges and wanted a boy in the room. Boy being, like, you know, 30 years old.
Yeah. It's fun because, like, Wheeler chides the founder, because he should know better, essentially,
yeah,
as a fucking founder. But it's still a fun twist because you as a reader would not necessarily expect, essentially.
Yeah, this is a great bit of roping the audience into the experience that the characters have. That, like, you could maybe think something's up with Clay, but he blends in so well, and that's because he exists to make you forget he was never there. I'm just going to rip the Band-Aid off. This is, I think, the weird thing about the Anti-Memetics Division is that it has a lot of memetics.
Yeah.
I mentioned Ojai, but also, like, Clay feels more like an idea that you're forced to think of rather than something that you forget about. And there's a bunch of other times where this happens, where it's more about ideas spreading too fast than it is about ideas being unable to spread. It's not really a problem because the story is really good. It's more so that it kind of muddles what the Anti-Memetics Division is, or, like, what they do. Because, like, they say Clay is an anti-meme, but they have to think about them. He has inserted himself into their minds. It feels more like a meme at that point.
It's a very interesting dichotomy. We're going to be talking about it more, but it is, like, the function of an anti-meme and a meme do seem to be pretty similar, ultimately. Whereas one simply wants you to think about it constantly, the other one wants you to not think about it constantly.
Yeah.
But the ways they work is still really interesting.
Generally, there's a difference between cognitohazard and meme, and a lot of the anti-memes are cognitohazards that you cannot think about normally. They're like stealth cognitohazards.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of typically memetic things in Foundation canon are, like, not at all stealth, but are very cognitohazardous, and they use the memedom to spread. So it's sort of like the vector of what they do is different, or the methods are different, but the result is the same, or, like, the intentions are the same.
Yeah.
If you can ascribe intentions. I do love, though, that you get this idea that Clay was doing this on purpose to specifically try and kill Marion.
Yeah.
This whole setup was to put Marion in a position where she would be executed.
Yeah.
Officially, even. And I kind of love that, because when talking about 55, Marion says, "We know it's not safe or Euclid," meaning it's most likely Keter, but she can't say that it's Keter, even if they've ruled out the other two.
Yeah.
And then she also says, "We know it's not stupid, and we know it's not alone." So it kind of implies, like, whatever 55 is, maybe Clay is somehow working with it.
Yeah. So, the next story.
Mm-hmm.
This is the
introduction to Anti-Memetics. It's your first day on the job, Paul Kim.
Yep.
Paul Kim. He is a reoccurring character, a member of the Anti-Memetics Division.
Yep, he is sitting alone at the cafeteria on his first day, and he is approached by, like, seemingly a high-ranking Foundation member or something. Alistair Gray?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun because he even thinks, like, this guy has no reason to be here. This guy's dressed way too fancy, looks out of place with all these, like, lab coats and nerds.
Yeah.
This guy's way too charismatic.
And so, yeah, Paul, like, chats with him for a little bit, but things keep seeming off where he's like, hang on, this guy looks like a high-ranking member, but he doesn't have a badge, he doesn't have a coat, he doesn't have anything. And
he keeps asking Paul questions, and Paul knows the answers to them, but it seems like Alistair Gray knows more than Paul does about Paul. Like, what's your relationship with your father? Paul says, "I never had a father, my mom raised me alone." And then Alistair is like, "That's what you think, but your relationship with him was really rocky." Paul's dad, for reference, is also a character who works in the Foundation.
Yeah.
It's very tragic, really. But turns out Alistair Gray is an anti-meme that is making Paul forget his life. And not only that.
Yep. Paul ends up running away when he realizes what is happening. One of the interesting things is that Alistair Gray basically, like, is omnipresent. It's like he is on the front layer of everything. So, like, it describes how he goes behind a table, but Alistair looks like he is in front of the table despite being physically behind it. And Paul, like, closes his eyes, but can still see him.
Have I ever told you about the bugged cruising cabinet they had at a restaurant in Florissant? How, like, it was bugged because it would show the opposite side of the polygons you were seeing. So, like, for a car model, it would show you the back face of the other side of the car, rather than the front face of the car side you're looking at. It's essentially that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think about it a lot. I want to say it was Cruising USA was the exact cruising game. But that's sort of what's going on here. Or I guess if you were to take a video of something and then put a sticker on top of the camera.
Yeah.
Like, not even, like, on the video so that you're filming the sticker. I mean, like,
a physical sticker on top of the camera.
Yeah.
So he ends up running away from Gray, and thinking quickly, he looks up the SCP number, which is, like, it's, like, G-R-E-Y 7... I don't remember the number of it.
B-C-D-E-F-G. It's a 7-E-5-H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O-P-Q-R. What is that, 16? That's too many.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember exactly how...
Is it a 3, like in Leet speak?
Yeah, like, I don't remember exactly how. I honestly did not fully follow the logic. I understand the idea, but I was just like... Is it like, you know, R is like 2 plus 1 for
is it no. The digital root?
Yeah. He manages to find the number, and the article is really interesting, because the article is essentially like, SCP number is a tall man who goes by the name of Alistair Gray. If you're reading this, you are already in his, like, you are already in his dimension, essentially, and need to get to this specific room in Site 19. Which is also a relevant site for this entire arc. And
it's actually, like, not Site 19.
It's Site 19.
It's Site 41.
41, that's
Site 19 is the most common site used throughout the SCP wiki. It's sort of like the placeholder for if you need a site, but you don't know which one off the top of your head. It's like kind of like the main branch in a way.
Yeah, site it's 40, the catch-all.
Yeah, Site 41 is specifically... the site that the anti-mimetics division is located within. So anyways, he goes to this office in Site 41. Along the way, he sees messages scrawled on the walls from further prior victims of Gray.
Yep, yeah. So he gets to the site, and the article essentially reads...
It's a message board.
Yeah, it's a message board. It's basically like, this SCP has taken a number of victims, which, like, there is a tally mark. It is literally like, Five tallies. The total is 79 before Paul Kim. And it's nice. Explained that it's like... No, it's not. It's also mentioned that this is only the tally of people who have specifically made it to the room, so he may have taken more. But the article is basically like, everything here is everything that previous people have attempted. So if they have attempted this and you're still reading this, then clearly it didn't work and you have to try something else. He's reading this on his phone and he gets to the bottom of the, like, elevator where Gray is. Gray is, like, standing outside. And he automatically, like, chucks his phone and Gray, like, gets hit in the skull, cracks it a bit, and it gives him a moment to leave. And he gets to the room, finds all the notes that are being scrawled and, like, you know, goes like, okay, this guy tried this, blah, blah, blah. And, like, he can see Alistair through the walls, like, just slowly approaching him as he's, like, desperately trying to find anything that works or think of anything that works. And Paul has a bit of an epiphany, which is that, essentially, conventional weaponry clearly did not work on him. Like, somebody says, I'll try hitting him with a baseball bat, I'll try shooting him with a gun. Does nothing. However, when he threw the phone at him, that cracked his skull. And Paul realizes that because his phone is essentially a mass of information and as an anti-meme, he is specifically, like, eating up information and, like, you know, trying to, you know, slurp up memories and whatnot. He realizes, wait, if I have something big and hefty enough that's just a gigantic mass of information, it might be enough to kill him.
So he creates a flail of multiple terabyte hard drives.
Yep.
And he he throws the hard drive flail at Gray, who, like, implodes.
Yeah.
He also does write down, like, hi, I'm going to try this.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other fun thing is, like, you know, once he has the plan, he, like, marks the tally and writes down what he's going to do. Another fun side thing is that Gray screams at him something like, do you remember your mother? And Paul replies like, I didn't have a mother, I was an orphan. Thus implying that, yeah, you know, he forgot about his father previously.
Yep.
But the short version is this works.
Mm-hmm.
And the next scene is Paul talking with Wheeler, where Paul is, you know, clearly shaken up about this. But as he's talking with Wheeler, he realizes, this clearly isn't my first day, actually. I just forgot about all my other days. And she's like, yep, mm-hmm. And he goes, I don't remember what she says, but she says something to the effect of, like, you know, most people tend to have this kind of experience. It'll go away with time. And Paul goes, so what you're saying is what you're saying is I can't wait for work. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to need a full report about the incident on my desk by tomorrow.
Yep. Yeah. That's a fun one. I think by now you've gotten the idea of both the threats they're facing and also the ways that this danger can affect them.
Yeah.
By making others forget and thus target them, or by making themselves forget. I think Mr. Gray is a very great example of how they have to fight things that they can't know about and can't strategize around, and they can't cooperate because only, you know, one person can know about it at a time.
Yeah.
It's sort of a microcosm of what the rest of the series is going to be.
Yeah.
So the next one is Unforgettable, That's What You Are. That's not like an affirmation. That's what the title of it is.
Yeah. It's like it's like the title of a 50s song.
You're unforgettable. So this introduces Lynn Marnus, the ex-director and ex-founder of the Anti-Mimetics Division, as well as an ex-government employee. He is on a boat, and he is retiring, and he's very, very old. And with him on the boat is who else but Marion Wheeler.
Yep.
And she is delivering some sort of serum injection into Lynn, and she is like, you died surrounded by loved ones, but also, we need you.
Yeah.
When you signed on to this, to foundation work, you signed that, you know, in the event of your death or your retirement, you will have a staged funeral, and then right before you die, we will extract all the information out of you and then kill you.
Yeah. And then you'll die.
So Marion is using Class Y Nestix here, which will, or no, this is Class X. Marion uses Class X Nestix on Lynn, and it makes him rewind time, essentially.
Yeah, it doesn't just, like, I don't think it just makes you remember. It literally, it's kind of a Fountain of Youth thing. Like, every dose is another 10 years off your life sort of thing.
Yeah, it de-ages him, and in the process, his, like, brain cells rebuild to where they were at those times.
Yeah.
So it's not just that he remembers, but it's more like his memory has been restored to how it originally was. And so she asked him a very simple question. What happened in 1976. And Lynn regales the story of how in the 1940s, he was part of a secret government project to destroy ideas. They wanted to destroy the concept of Nazis.
Yep.
It didn't work, because their group, the Unthinkables, which is a great group name,
yeah,
accidentally created an anti-meme bomb.
Yeah. It is described as, like, something that was going on in tandem with the Manhattan Project.
Exactly.
And so, like, they created an anti-meme bomb. And, like, they as he describes it, they created three in total. The first one the one that they used on the cult?
No, the first one exploded in testing.
Yeah, the first one exploded accidentally.
Yeah, the second one, they realized that they had 4 months of lost research, and they're like, wait, hold on, what happened? What were we doing? Oh. And they rebuilt the new bomb, but because they lost, or no, it was 4 years of research, and because they had lost that time, by the time they had finished doing the research again, the war was done.
Yeah.
The Nazis were defeated as best as they could.
Yeah.
and this is already after Japan had been bombed as well. So, like, you know, the U.S. was making babies. And Lin was kind of out of a job for a while before the Foundation took in the Unthinkables and turned them into the first anti-mimetics division.
Yeah. I love the process that he describes, because it's like, they built the first bomb, it went off accidentally. They built the second bomb, they sat on it forever, unable to really do anything with it. They built a, until I think the cult, that's when they finally use it. And then they built a third bomb to delete themselves from the U.S. Department, basically.
Yeah. The one with the cult, so in this story, it mentions that the Ojai incident happened in 1951. When the original 1425 to me always sounded more like 2000s, I am going to take this as a bit of Quantum did not write 1425 and is taking some creative liberties to flesh out the timeline a bit better.
Yeah.
So you might be thinking, though, why did they detonate the third bomb? The reason is actually because something bad happened to the first anti-mimetics division. Lin is starting to realize that he couldn't remember anything past 1976, so he takes another dose of the Class X Nestix. Class X Nestix. Say that 10 times fast. Really check for your pop filter working. Good microphone warm-up. But takes another dose, remembers a whole separate team to the one that he left Marion in charge of, and he realizes that all of them died except for himself, and the only way to stop the event that was transpiring was to set off their nuke. So a thing in SCP canon is that every site has an on-site nuclear warhead to detonate in case of emergency. I don't think that'll help much, considering, like, take for example 682, a nuke isn't going to stop that, but it is a last-ditch effort.
If nothing else works, you know, might as well detonate a nuke about it.
In the anti-mimetics division version is the bomb that Lin Marnus helped build. It is their version of an on-site warhead, is the on-site anti-mimetic warhead.
Yeah.
So what happened in 76 is that something almost killed the entire anti-mimetics division because they found out about it. Lin mentions that by making him remember this, it has brought this SCP back. And Marion realizes she has to kill him now. She aims a gun. She mentions that the thing is in Lin's left eye. This is like a really common thing in the anti-mimetics division saga, is that things appear in people's eyes.
Yeah.
Both their own field of view and to others, which I think is interesting. She is slightly too late because as she's aiming the gun, huge bladed spider legs claw out of Lin's throat. And they try to, like, lift up the boat and essentially crush Marion.
Yeah.
She takes a big dose of anesthetics to forget this spider leg monster thing and jumps ship and is later found by the mobile task force who you know, found her and retrieved her. However, once she's found, she doesn't remember what she was doing.
I like that one of the, like, hints that she has that something is wrong is that her and Lin are on a lake. Like, they're in a boat on a lake, I believe. But she realizes as, you know, kind of shit's hitting the fan, she's like, why didn't I bring backup? I don't remember bringing backup. I would have brought backup. The fact that I don't remember means something's wrong.
Yeah. There's sort of an implication that even before she administered the Nestix to Lin, something was already messing with her.
Yeah.
Orchestrating this to happen. Now, I want to note a few things. One, Marion's married. Lin calls her a different last name.
Like Hutchinson?
Yeah, Hutchinson. Lin calls her Marion Hutchinson, and Marion's like, it's Wheeler now, but that's fine.
Yeah.
So Marion's married, but she's never mentioned her partner whatsoever.
Interesting.
Interesting. Also, there is a line at the very first paragraph that says that Lin's body was dying on the bed like a crumpled up spider. Spiders are very important. So, but yeah, this sort of is... There is a bigger threat to the anti-mimetics division as a whole.
Yeah, there's always a bigger fish.
There's a very big... It's not even a fish, it's more of like a, I don't know, a cephalopod maybe? But we'll get to that in the next one, Case Colorless Green.
So,
SCP-3125.
SCP-3125 is contained within a room that has very little information, besides the, like, physical structure of it and the fact that the head of the anti-mimetics division has to visit it at least once every 42 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
As Wheeler is going towards it, Kim is actually there again.
Yay!
And Kim is essentially casting down on the whole thing, like, sorry, that's the only information we have? No! What if it kills you? What if, like, you know, what if you don't have backup? And Wheeler's just sort of like, nah, I trust this. I'm gonna try and contain myself here, but there's one detail. Didn't even try to make that joke. One detail that I love, which is that Kim says something to the effect of, like, we don't even know who built this. And Marion's like, it's obvious that Bart Hughes built it because of, like, the design philosophy. And it has note about, like, you know, it has all of his hallmarks, sleek white design, plain glass, blah, blah, blah. I want to focus in on this for a moment. The idea being presented here is that the foundation, obviously it has to have architects. And because it has architects, clearly it would probably have a couple of key architects. Like, you know, like real architecture probably has specific design philosophies and stuff. And so Quantum Whole-Ass makes a fucking guy.
Mm-hmm.
He makes up a guy. I want to focus in on the idea, like the world building here.
Yeah.
Of there is a designer whose hallmarks are well known enough in the SCP Foundation that, like, the head of a division can clearly tell he's the one who built it.
There's a bit more to that. So Bart Hughes was briefly mentioned in We Need to Talk About 55 as being the designer for the containment unit of 55.
Yeah.
And the overseer is like, Bart Hughes doesn't exist. There's nobody like that in Foundation tenure. But Bart Hughes did exist or does exist, meaning that Bart Hughes is more specifically an anti-mimetics division, like, member, because that's the only reason the overseer would have forgotten about him.
Yeah.
So there are also clues to who exactly Bart Hughes is, purely in those little bits. But yeah, I love that Bart Hughes has an art style.
Yeah, it's such it an insane great. Fucking detail. Like, what happened here is the SCP Foundation was made. It was expanded on. A lot of writers contributed to it. And it is a collaborative fiction wiki that then one guy who was like, I'm going to make a fun story, just kind of like invented, you know, this really interesting little idea of history in the Foundation that makes a whole lot of ludonarrative sense. Ludonarrative is not the
fucking dog shit. It's just narrative sense. Yeah. It's cohesive.
It makes a whole lot of narrative sense, but it's insane. It's an insane detail to be like, yeah, there's an architect guy who's like, who has a very signature style in the SCP Foundation.
Yeah. For one thing, considering the Foundation has like infinite money, more or less, and is willing to give a blank check if it means safe containment, it doesn't surprise me there are people who will care about the aesthetics because they have the money to do so.
Yeah.
Also, like, this is sort of a world-building thing I love, which is, like, filling in gaps. I think if you go around the video game critique side, or the side of the internet, you might run into the what-do-they-eat argument.
Yeah.
Which is a way of being, like, in a fictional universe, people have basic needs they have to meet. We know that for a fact. And a way for a universe to feel more real, not necessarily realistic, but like realized, complete, is to answer those questions. What do they eat? Where do they work? How do they play? You know, what's their imports and exports? What's the economy? And so you can apply that to a lot of other things. I think one of my favorite bits with like when magic is involved in fantasy stories is like, is magic used by the lay people? Or is magic, like, so hard to learn that only these people can learn it?
Yeah.
You know, what aspects of elves make them act elvish, and why would they act like that given, like, their environment or, you know, anything like that? In this case, it's more so like, well, we can recognize that not every containment unit is the same, and they have these specifications. Who determines the specifications? Who actually does the engineering to design them to work?
It's so good. Okay.
So, inside the containment unit, Marion Wheeler watches a video of herself.
It's full of, like, hastily scrawled notes and, like, really shaky handwriting.
Yeah. Since there's only so much they can take in, and they're not allowed to take notes on anything inside, they're even checked for notes, like fucking Severance.
Yeah.
Marion sees all these things, like, written on the walls, even. In the video, Marion on the video is Marion in the past, having gone into the bunker. It's a bunker. That's the big reveal.
Yeah.
This is not a containment unit. It's reverse containment. It is shielded from SCP-3125.
Because SCP-3125 is everywhere that isn't this unit.
Yes. And this, I think, is where it gets really fucked up. Marion on the video starts talking about the idea of 3125, that it is, like, they don't know quite exactly what it is, but once they start researching antimimetics, they run into it. It's sort of a dead end in research. Every time anyone researches antimimetics, they come across 3125.
Which is dangerous, because coming across 3125 kind of means you're not going to exist anymore.
She says it kills you and kills anyone who thinks like you. Keep that in mind. I love, there's a line she says, like, you draw four or five data points together into a single shape and you see it, and it sees you. Five is sort of an arc number. 3125 is 5 to the power of 5. And think about what a shape with 5 points is, but a star.
Oh!
And isn't that what the Ojai Church was all about? This, of course, led to the common depiction of 3125 as a cosmic starfish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cosmic gummy worm.
Specifically, Marion draws a picture, the Marion on the video draws a picture of a hand that is just 5 fingers in, like, a pattern growing out from all ends.
Yeah, it's like 5 fingers of equal length.
Yeah, and then a pentagon on the palm with a mouth in it. This is, okay, I think this is the point where you might realize what is going on. This is peak, pure cosmic horror without racism.
Yeah!
So,
good on you, SCP Foundation!
Yeah, so cosmic horror is a type of horror built around the idea of certain things being incongruous with humanity. That there are powers that are not only higher than humans, but unknowable powers that are so beyond human comprehension because they're so far from what we are familiar with. The idea that we're not alone in space, there could be anything out there, is one of the core anxieties to cosmic horror. But in this case, the cosmic horror is not just, like, space alien or, like, evil cult. It is an idea that cannot be thought about.
Yeah, it's an idea that cannot be thought about, and, like, a threat that is literally present at all times that you're just not thinking about.
A common thread in many cosmic horror series, not just Lovecraft, but things like The King in Yellow, for example, is the idea that thinking about it leads to obsession and makes you think about it more, and that obsession leads to death. This series sort of codifies those into a scientific language, that they are thought about because they are cognitohazards, they lead to death because they're dangerous and hazardous, but they're so hard to find and, like, so secret because they are unknowable.
Yeah.
It takes the tropes and conventions of cosmic horror, which was honestly kind of born originally out of xenophobia, but also has a lot of anxieties related to space-age worries and, well, I guess space-age worries had a lot of xenophobia as well. But, like, paranoia, and in this case, the idea that, like, research can be dangerous.
Yeah.
Note that in the timeline, one of the earliest events coincides with the Manhattan Project. There is a very common thing in the SCP that hubris is the downfall of people.
Yeah.
That by learning so much, and by dedicating themselves to learn so much, they have often cursed themselves. And this is the perfect example. That their research into anomalous things to try to contain them always leads them at the doorstep of a cosmic entity that wants to kill them all.
One of the interesting things in the room that's explained is that, like, the number of people in the antimimetics division is, like, exponentially decreasing.
Yes.
Like, she says something like, there used to be 4,000 workers, at time of recording there's 125. It's estimated that by the end of 2015 there will be none of us left.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, yeah, the idea of, by trying to know something, by trying to research it so that you can contain it, so that you can kill it, so that you can whatever, you are just putting yourself at danger, and not just yourself, but, like, a significant amount of people around you.
Yeah.
Is real fucking interesting, real horrifying.
And it's interesting to note, though, that when Lin mentioned that making him remember it brought it back, he was talking about 3125, obviously.
Yeah.
Spider legs, kind of like the fingers and all that. But also, if you think about who thinks like Lynn Marnus, Marion Wheeler is number one on that list.
Yeah.
So Marion learning about 3125, going into the bunker, and all of that, and further understanding and knowing about it, seems to just be almost a consequence of making Lynn remember it.
Yeah.
It's fucked up, and I love this idea that there is a dead end to research that is literal dead. It kills you. And it works so well with the Foundation, because this thing that thinks they know everything doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
However, this I feel like it still goes to the problem of antimimetics as a kind of weird concept, because like the thing that you think about it and then everyone who thinks like you thinks about it and dies, that feels way more like a meme again than an anti-meme. And it's like, yes, the symbols of 3125 are normally cloaked and invisible and hidden to most people. I just think, I don't know. I guess the idea is just that if you look for it, it'll kill you. But if you don't look for it, you're fine. But then things like the Ojai Church are shown to be manifestations of 3125's will, that it does want to influence Earth and destroy it or something. But to do so, it has to stay hidden and hide itself. But like it does, you know,
it is a confusing concept that is not always 100% explainable. But I would also sort of say, like, the idea of something acting, you know, the idea of an anti-something acting like the original something, the idea of like dark matter acting like matter, for example. I don't know. I see the intent.
Intent. I think it's more so the position of trying to explain this is makes it much harder than the position of reading it.
True.
Because so, I feel like I'm responsible for explaining what an anti-meme exactly is and what its properties are, but I don't even feel like the series does that well enough, and maybe that's the point.
Oh, don't worry. I have something that I'm going to be saying at the end of this because it's sort of my wrap-up thoughts. But an anti-meme is essentially the space left behind when you look at all of the information you don't know.
Yeah.
That's like I think there's a moment where...
And if you don't know, then now you know.
I think there's a moment where Marion says something like, if you can't see the puzzle piece, you can still fill in all of the pieces surrounding it to get the shape.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the specific story.
So Marion on the TV is like, we can't fight this. There's no hope in this. And Marion, in the current Marion, is like, no, we gotta be able to fight this. Come on.
Yeah, she like, it's really heartbreaking because Wheeler looks at her and is like, you're not like this. Why are you so defeated? And it's just like, yeah, it's really sad. But she kind of goes like, okay, I have an idea.
Yeah, she remembers that Bart Hughes built another much larger containment facility in like the Site 41 basement.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what's in there because, again, it's similar to this one, but there's got to be something there.
Should be noted as well that this specific basement is actually mentioned in the Lynn chapter. He is the one who says it, but because she forgets everything that happened, obviously she doesn't know until she recognizes this in this chapter.
Also, it's mentioned that Bart Hughes has gone missing. And Marion believes that that's because Bart Hughes has essentially locked himself inside of this containment thing.
Yeah.
This bunker.
But she Marion does one of the most badass things in fiction.
She bumps her head.
She bumps her head. So she exits the room and Paul is like trying to come up to her. He's like, okay, you good? I'm going to need to, you know, debrief you with the amnestics or whatever. And she's like pretty clearly kind of groggy. She's like, okay, hang on, hold on. I got a second. But then Paul comes at her with a knife.
Yeah. So what happens is Marion says like, I think I remember the plan. And Paul's like, you shouldn't be able to remember anything. Hold up. I need to stab you with a little juice. But then, like, he takes out a knife and he says, like, are you okay? It looks like there's something on your throat.
Yeah.
Hold on, let me cut it out. My theory is that he saw the thing behind the ear that was one of the, like, inspiration SCPs for this.
Yeah.
But either way, he tries to cut her throat open.
Yeah.
And also, he speaks in, like, a non-tongue.
Yeah, that's a recurring thing, is that people, like, affected by anti-memes will... It's literally jumbled text.
It's something that appears in the Ojai book. It is a, like... It's very Rylea, the, like, cult city group thing in Lovecraft mythos.
Yeah.
Where they have like a weird way of talking. It's all jumbled letters. It's a staple of cosmic horror, is people speaking language that isn't like language.
Yeah. So she manages to escape from Kim and runs away. I believe this leads into the final story.
Smash cut to your last first day.
Yes. She is... So, Site 41 is going through shit. Yeah. Everything's fucked up. 3125 is, like, doing its big play. Everyone's affected by it, except her, essentially. And, like, as she's running away, she's like... She says something like, "Can't fucking believe this is happening on my first day."
Yeah.
But... like, she essentially slowly realizes, slowly pieces together, she's like, "No, hang on. The fact that I know what's going on, the fact that I know what I'm trying to do next means this isn't my first day. I've done this before." And so, like, she's like, "I gotta remember what to do." But here's the thing. She does remember what to do, because she took Class Z Nestics. So Class Z Nestics destroy your ability to forget.
Which means... that you get sensory overload. The idea is that you are processing so much information and your mind filters a lot of it and only gives you what's necessary.
Yeah, your mind filters, like, you know, the wind on your skin, the brief,
your nose,
you know,
in front of your eyes.
Your heart beating in your chest.
Your tongue in your mouth.
Yeah.
The feeling of clothes on your skin.
And so like, yeah.
The rest. I also wanted to mention really quick that the sort of mindful walking through that Marion does is shown to be like a type of training they give to people at this division. It's also, if you go on to like lucid dreaming message boards and shit, that's like a lucid dreaming technique, is to in a dream be like, "How'd I get here?"
Ah, that's interesting.
I think that's kind of fun.
That is fun. Also, but, another side note, she has a weapon.
Yeah.
She has an anomalous weapon. She has an SCP that's like a gun from another planet. Mm-hmm. That, like, basically just, like, it seems like it does nothing, but it
doesn't do anything.
it destroys an X-shaped hole in whatever you shoot it at, but it makes no sound, has no recoil. It's like clicking a trigger on a toy gun, except that it fucking decimates someone.
Yeah, it's from a planet that can't be detected or measured, and the gun itself has a bit of that anti-mimetic property.
Yeah.
Hence why they have it there. So she proceeds to run through the division, going into the elevator where there's more buttons than there used to be.
Yeah.
Great bit. Buttons on the elevator themselves are anti-mimetic. She also sees messages left by previous victims of Mr. Gray.
Yeah.
Which is a great bit of continuity.
Including a corpse that, like, is just sitting in the corner rotting, but, like, not even the flies will touch it because they don't know it's there.
Yeah.
She describes, like, it kind of describes, like, the things she is noticing that are anti-mimetic now. And one of the things is there are small worms that scratches out of her hair, which are one of the, like, most successful mimetic agents, anti-mimetic agents.
They're so, like, in every biome.
They're in every biome, often in every room. Like, they are just these little tiny worms that just kind of don't do anything. Like, they're entirely benign. And they just get by because nothing knows that they're there. Yeah, it's a horrible thought.
I've had nightmares about worms being all over the floor.
However, this is actually... remember this for the next episode, because this is sort of the, I think, first time we see anti-mimetic field as, like, a biological process that some animals can do, and that will be relevant.
She also hears a hum, like a loud drone, and I love the idea of the hum being an anti-mimetic thing.
Yeah. Just the sound in your head is an anti-mimetic.
Yeah. So she, I have other sounds in my head, but she runs down the elevator over to this bunker underground, which is the size of a hockey stadium, and Paul Kim is following her with a fucking knife.
Yeah. She's being followed by a bunch of the other researchers, basically, who are all affected by 3125.
Mm-hmm. She is able to enter the bunker for a brief moment of silence. And she realizes there's nothing there. There's no weapon to combat 3125. The plan in her head was to create an idea that could be ascended to essentially fight 3125 in the noosphere, which, if you remember from the previous episode, is the cosmological sphere of every idea that can possibly be thought by humans. I do want to note that whether or not 3125 actually exists within the noosphere is dubious in terms of canon. It seems like in the Antimimetics Division, it is part of the Noosphere, but in other stories it is often depicted as being outside the Noosphere.
Yeah.
It won't come up in this story, luckily, but also, like, so she essentially wants to create the perfect hero to kill 3125, but there's no means to do that in the room. There's just a nuke.
Yeah.
It's the on-site nuke yet again.
Yep, she was going down to the, like, the area, basically under the assumption that Bart Hughes either built something, or maybe that Bart Hughes himself was still there, working on it until she came to him and was like, hey, turn on the machine now. But it's not there, it's just the nuke.
There's no Bart either.
Yeah, there's no Bart. It's just a truck that looks empty to everyone that isn't her, and the anti-mimetic nuke. And there's this really heartbreaking line of where, like, she collapses finally because she's basically having a seizure, more or less. Her brain's just like we said, her brain is continuing to remember everything. And she collapses and she says, she thinks something like, that's right, I forgot what world this is. I thought this was the world where we win sometimes. And so, like, as she's laying down, like, verging on brain death, the Paul Kim and the other researchers come up, and they're like, yeah, let's start with her eyes.
Paul enters the room, picks up the ray gun, which Marion had dropped, and uses it to open holes in the bunker.
Yeah.
For both the other researchers and 3125 itself to enter through. Also, super important moment. Either at the end of the previous chapter or sometime during this one, Marion thinks of the name Adam.
Yeah, that's right. The name Adam comes up.
She doesn't want to remember him. Not just that she can't, but she doesn't want to, because Adam was her husband, who she forgot about.
Spoilers?
No, that's pretty much outright said in this one.
I mean, it is, yeah.
Yeah, but faced with pretty much just absolute death and the end of the world as we know it, in front of her, she activates the nuke.
Yep, the ending line, like, as Paul holds the knife above her eye, she whispers something, she whispers, like, don't you get it, Paul, there is no Antimimetics Division, and then the world goes black.
Yep.
Like, literally not, no one except for her hears the nuke go off.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, like, the world goes blank, and that is the end of the There Is No Antimimetics Division storyline.
Part one.
Yeah, part one.
I think this is really cool. So one of the fun bits of SCP sort of writing is that it tends to follow a almost like an ARG or web series-esque belief of, like, this is real, you just don't know about it. The Foundation's levels of secrecy are so complex that, you know, normal civilians aren't supposed to know. They have something they call the Veil, which is essentially the masquerade.
Yeah.
The, like, line of kayfabe where the general populace believe that something is the way the world is, and they don't know about the anomalous side. And keeping them from knowing about the anomalous side is one of the protect aspects of the Foundation.
Yeah.
But also, this is why there are things like we are accessing an in-universe wiki to read about these articles, and they're not entirely prose, is because they are written under the assumption or the sort of veneer of this being a real life thing you just don't know about. The on-site warhead is great because we know that it's going to stop the outbreak of 3125 at the cost of Marion's life, because that's more or less what happened to Lynn. However, the reason that 3125 didn't get out of Site 41 and terrorize real life is also because of this.
Yeah.
The reason we don't know about things like the Ojai Church or all of this is because of the nuke going off. It's almost like a return to status quo, but in the way that it just cements the fiction of SCP Foundation.
Yeah. The world has ended in the SCP Foundation universe multiple times. Last episode I mentioned the button that just prints an entire new world with new people in it.
Yeah, Yellowstone.
Yeah, just if you need an entire new sort of reality, you can just hit the button because it's like, well, this one sucks. We accidentally waked the Scarlet King. Boop. But Marion sort of, like, realizes in her final moments that, like, essentially this was all just to stave off the inevitable, and that, you know, it's kind of just going to have to be up to whoever the next person is to do it. But I also feel like the fact that it goes off with 3125 in the room, like, if this was just, you know, if this was the only thing of the story, you could probably read it a little bit as, like, this also killed 3125 because it was in the room as well.
I still don't think it was in the room at all.
I'm fairly certain it's described as being in the room, although I'm not, you know, I wouldn't lay down my life for
the,
that.
The thing is that 3125 is always depicted as we are viewing, like, the surface of it, but seeing the surface is toxic.
Yeah.
3125 is at least noted to be in the noosphere, hence why ascending an idea above humanity, above reality, to the noosphere is a way to counter it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it doesn't have a physical form, but it has manifestations which include the people affected by the, like, mind virus. The woke mind virus.
The woke mind virus.
Makes people bite their fingers off.
SCP-6969 is a woke mind virus.
Yeah.
So, okay. To get to closing thoughts.
One more thing,
yeah,
by the way.
Please do.
She mentions that, I don't remember if it's the video Marion or Marion after not forgetting
Marion after not surviving,
yeah.
Mans.
That I don't remember which one says it, but one of them says that 3125 is five-dimensional, and note that a square is two-dimensional and a cube is three-dimensional, hence why to the power of two is square and to the power of three is cube.
Yeah,
so five-dimensional would be to the power of five.
Five
starfish.
So, okay, to get to closing thoughts, I love Anti-Mimetics Division, and I think what it does so brilliantly. So, the SCP Wiki, as it exists, kind of exists, like, with the specific articles. The specific articles is the entirety of the story, quote-unquote, the canon storyline of the Wiki. What Anti-Mimetics does is it essentially, through the world building it gives, through the use of the SCPs that already have the sort of anti-mimetic bit about them, it fleshes out not only the world that is there, because obviously there's going to be SCPs that we just, you know, don't know about, or that we haven't captured yet, that sort of thing. It fleshes out the world that isn't there. To harken back to the idea of, like, the Anti-Mimetics Division is essentially about putting together puzzle pieces so that you can look at the shape of the void of a puzzle piece. The story itself kind of does something similar for the SCP Foundation, whereby it doesn't just flesh out the idea that, like, there are SCPs that we don't know about right now, but that there are SCPs that are, like, in some way unknowable and we are still trying to know them. It is a brilliant piece of writing because it doesn't just inspire you to think about, like, what could be there, but what could be there without anybody realizing. What if there's just a guy who is in every site who just kind of, like, stands there and no one notices him? He's just sort of sitting there, jorking his peanuts.
God, the guy in the corner of the club.
Yeah.
I like it because I think there is a lot of fun in reading the individual SCP articles, but I love it when people try to tie them together into a grander thing. It's not necessarily it has to all be connected to one big bad like the 3125. 3125 is often one of the, like, big villains, I think. If you hear people talk about, like, the main antagonist, quote-unquote, you'll hear, like, Scarlet King. 3125 is usually shortly afterwards.
Yeah.
Whatever the hell was in 5000. the like, guy with a crooked jaw or whatever. And then sometimes the Antifabula as well, but, you know. But, like, I think it's also more so, I just like seeing the way these interact on, like, a daily basis. How, like, things like the Ojai Church and the spooky hand spiders and the thing behind the ear are connected, but not necessarily being, like, variants of some cosmic being, but just, like, these are multiple things the Foundation deals with, and so people will have dealt with them multiple times.
Yeah.
I think, like, similarly to what you said about, like, the holes that you make from the puzzle pieces being a room for other SCPs or other things, I view it also, like, holes made by the puzzle pieces of the articles create a shape of the actual daily workings of the Foundation,
yeah,
the lives of the people there. And I think that's when the tales for SCP really shine, is when they highlight the lives of the workers in a way that then makes you remember that they're all part of the same universe. I want to compare it to Pokemon Snap.
Yeah.
And new Pokemon Snap, especially. Those games are kind of focused on displaying the natural behaviors of Pokemon that are listed in the Pokedex. But that's because in Pokemon games, you don't really get to see them act like animals. Even Pokemon that have, like, specific behavioral things listed, or especially ones that interact with other Pokemon, like Marini and Corsola, you don't really see that happen in the games. You can be told about them, but they're not depicted. So when Pokemon Snap comes along and shows you those things, it helps you remember that the world is a lot more detailed than what you're thinking about.
Yeah.
These aren't just monsters. These are monsters where somebody had to build their containment unit. Somebody has to research them. Somebody has to fight them.
And more often than not, somebody has to, like, do some kind of daily task with them to remember them or, you know, to do something to keep them at bay.
And they have coworkers. They have meetings with their bosses. They have a break room and a cafeteria.
They have first days.
Yeah.
You know?
They have Employee of the Month awards in their lungs. I think that's part of why I love this. I also just love it because it's good cosmic horror.
Yeah.
And, like, it's easy to think of all of internet horror being this weird new modern thing. But so much of it is founded on these traditional ideas, similarly to how 682 I described as being more gothic in terms of its monstrous form. This is very clearly Lovecraft-inspired, especially when you get to the starfish bit.
Yeah.
The hand with the fingers and the mouth in it is like, that's like a thing. You can have that as a pet in Kingdom of Loathing. It's reinterpreted through a new lens and a new medium, and I love that. I love it when people are able to tie disparate threads together into a beautiful knot. I'm a fucking Boy Scout. What do you want from me?
Yeah. The SCP Foundation is I think, one of the most beautiful things that humanity has created. And I will die on that hill.
Yeah, it's like SCP Foundation, Statue of David, Sistine Chapel.
Penicillin.
Penicillin, insulin. And then we have, like,
Sonic, Shadow the Hedgehog.
Yeah, Shadow the Hedgehog. Sonic Underground. Sonic 3 Knuckles, which is below those other two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we have Sonic 3 on its own without Knuckles.
Then we have putting other Genesis games on top of the and Knuckles cartridge. So, yeah, it's a great one. Read it. But also, we're only halfway through it.
Yeah.
But we're at the end of an episode.
This is only a part one. We're going to make a part two, and ideally at the end of that part two, you know, we'll have a consistent narrative that, I don't know, hopefully won't do anything terrible, like delete this entire episode.
Yeah. Wait, hold on. What did we just do an episode on?
I'm not sure. You'll remember it while you're editing, right?
Because we just did an episode.
Yeah.
Which means, okay, I think we should at least do the outro.
Yeah, let's just do the outro and then we'll figure it out.
Yeah. So thank you for listening. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know if there's things you think we should cover or things you think we might like. You can also follow us on Blue Sky at Blue Sky at netsurferpro.beesguy.social and on Twitter at netsurferpro. Where you can get updates on episodes, when things are going to be delayed or going live, as well as teasers for upcoming episodes. I have to figure out what a teaser for what we're doing after part two of this is going to be, because it's kind of a hard thing to really contain within emojis.
Well, it's a hard thing to contain, period.
Well, yeah.
As for myself, if you want the comedy stylings of Galen, you can find me on... Yeah, well, usually you do it first, but this rolls off the tongue, so... as for myself, you can find me on Twitter and on Blue Sky. Don't even follow me on Twitter. You can find me on Blue Sky and on TikTok at Galen Wilson. That's at galenwsn.bscott.social for Blue Sky. I post my hot takes and videos and whatnot. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where I'm literally going to be recording a video after today, actually. And you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire. Where can they find you, though?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Twackaroo or twack.beesguy.social, where I post hot takes, cold takes, things I like, rant about diabetes and the health, the pharmaceutical industry, a bunch of fun stuff. I also post there when I'm working on new projects. You can find links to all my other different projects, like my mashups, my YouTube channel, and my stream at twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I've been trying to stream more regularly. We've been playing Echoes of Wisdom, and that's been fun. But what I'm really excited for is Shadowvember. Every November, which is Diabetes Awareness Month, I stream Shadow the Hedgehog. And for every $50 I raise for diabetes research, I have to play through the game again. I have played through the game maybe 20 times already through previous Shadowvembers. And I'm still not even like a tenth of the way done with 100%ing it. If you don't know why, let's just say the game's ridiculous. And it's a great time and you can support diabetes research, which is very important.
Yeah, if you don't know why, maybe watch the stream.
You can see the fun cutscenes everyone loves.
Yeah. But hey, as for us, we've been NetSurfer Pro. This has been our 50th episode. I'm really excited.
I know. It's wild how we did 50 episodes by 2023.
Yeah.
I hope nothing happens to this episode. You know, I've already lost a few episodes to just my computer bugging out.
Yeah. It would be a real shame to lose an episode to something even worse.
Or, like, what if we just forgot to upload it, you know?
Forgot to upload what?
Huh?